Welcome to season 4 of the Intersection Hub podcast. This season, we are changing the conversation. We are going to go beyond talking about the challenges the charitable sector faces and start spotlighting charities who are offering us hope, hope for a new way forward in 3 primary areas. That's right. In this season, we are sharing 8 real examples of organizations who are advancing anti-racist work, moving forward with trust-based philanthropy, and taking care of the physical and mental well-being of their staff. So thank you for sharing a little bit of your day with us. Let's get to it. In 2020, our guest Marissa DeSales published an article that unleashed all the years of built-up trauma that she experienced as the only BIPOC fundraiser in her white-dominated organization. In this conversation, Marissa recounts her experience of microaggressions and her shock at realizing that she had been complicit in maintaining the status quo of racism in her organization. Marissa now helps nonprofits strategize their growth by focusing on the health of the systems they use, including data management systems, marketing and communication systems, and organizational structures. Her work is informed by community-centric fundraising, a movement seeking to prioritize equity in fundraising. This movement favors a more collaborative approach that honors the inherent strengths within community members. Marissa's specialty is working with emerging organizations in search of growth, and in particular, organizations led by and focused on issues affecting Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Marissa and I candidly talk about her experience of code switching, altering her voice to sound white on the telephone, and changing her behavior and her appearance to fit in a white dominant culture. We also discuss the discomfort of acknowledging our collective privilege and concrete first steps we can take to stop causing harm to each other. One of those concrete first steps is a confession. I must confess to you that this conversation was sometimes awkward and difficult. I was tempted to edit out moments where my white privilege and ignorance is on full display. In conversation with Marissa, we chose to keep those parts in to serve as an example of what BIPOC people have to deal with on a daily basis in our sector. To Marissa, I apologize for my ignorance and am deeply grateful to her for her grace and her compassion. Let's dig in. Marissa, I am so grateful to come to know you and to learn more about your work, and that you are willing to spend a little bit of time talking to me about that amazing article. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're so kind, Kimberly. It's funny because as a writer, you know, you evolve and mature as a person, right? But your work doesn't, right? It sits there at time at the moment you wrote it. And so I took a glance back at it in preparation for our chat today. And of course, I'm cringing. I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I made that phrase. It's terrible. Oh, this is just, oh, I would have done this completely differently. You know, so
well, it's fresh for me. So I didn't have that perspective when I read it. And as I say to people all the time, we are constantly emerging as new versions of ourselves. So so I'm grateful to talk to you and learn more about your work and your perspective on all of that. Before we dig in, what's one thing people might be surprised to know about you that isn't obvious from your LinkedIn page or your bio?
I don't know. I feel like I put so much of myself out there that I feel as though I'm a fairly open book. Anybody that knows me knows that I love dirt, I love soil, I love gardening. It's at the root of my practice in life, and it's what I named my business after, because I find constantly, daily, I find metaphors in the garden and in my work in the garden and how it relates to, you know, changing the world generally.
You're in Sacramento, is that right?
I am. Yeah, I moved here as a preteen, and Sacramento is capital of California, of course. And so the main economy here are two things. One is the state government, because, you know, we have the economy of a small country, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of state infrastructure. And the other is agriculture, because we're right at the center of, you know, the Central Valley of California. And so it makes this amazing bowl going down the middle of the state that's full of just the most absolutely rich soil you could imagine.
You know, one of my favorite smells is, it happens in the spring in Canada. And I don't know if you have the same thing that happens, because the seasons aren't as distinct as they are. But when the snow starts to melt and the earth starts to grow, to warm up, there is this earthy, musky smell to the air. And I love it.
I recently discovered that there's a company that sells a perfume that smells like moist earth, and I cannot wait to get my hands on it. Doesn't that smell, sound like it would smell amazing?
So we both find joy and peace in our garden. Many people think of their garden and the joyful part of the flowers, but you go right deep to the dirt, and I love learning that about you. I wanted to talk to you today, and we're deviating a little bit from our focus this season, because I think your experience when you did work in the charitable sector at your last job is worth amplifying and talking about, because the article of I'm the fly in your milk, I think it was called. Is that what it was called?
12 Years a Fly in the Milk. It was kind of a play on the movie 12 Years a Slave.
Okay. And in that article, you disclosed that you are a Black woman.
I am.
Might have seemed obvious, but...
Well, to, you know, a viewer that, a listener, excuse me, of your podcast, it may not be, you know, immediately apparent, but I'll give you a visual description. Sure. Of myself. I'm a light-skinned African-American woman of middle-ish age, and I have short, curly hair that is currently tied behind my face in a ponytail out of pure laziness. And I typically wear really bright colors, although today I'm in a bit of a muted plum purple.
And we, I think we're going gray sort of at the same rate, where you can see it when your hair is up, but you can't see it when your hair is down.
Yes.
I love it. I love showing that wisdom every once in a while, but yeah.
Hey, somebody tried to give me a senior discount. I mean, I let them the other day in the store. No, I might be a year or some shy of the requirement, but I'm going to take that gray discount, you know, inflation.
Tell us where you used to work.
Yeah, so I worked for a really actually amazing organization here in Sacramento that did therapeutic horseback riding and horse-related interactions for children and adults with special needs or disabilities. And so I had a front seat to miracles, as I like to call it, where I would witness children being lifted out of their wheelchairs and placed on the back of the gentlest, kindest, you know, stock still, trying not to breathe too hard, steed, who would then, you know, very carefully carry them through a series of exercises designed to strengthen their body and improve their mind and all of those wonderful things. And so I stayed there. I started as a volunteer, and I became the volunteer coordinator on staff, and then worked my way into the community outreach manager, because my heart has always been in marketing and storytelling. And I quickly found that it was an outlet for me to use and grow those skills. And it was a wonderfully compelling story to be able to tell and share with people. So I treasured my time there, especially the frontline program work with the children.
You were there for quite some time, weren't you?
12 years. I was, 12 years.
I'm curious.
And then the pandemic hit, right? So it was It was a Friday. It was beautifully sunny, and we were preparing for our spring programming. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had just designed a program to include older adults in our programming, because my mother had been just diagnosed with dementia. And I wondered whether the benefits of our program might be also extended to folks that are suffering from that and other disorders related to aging. So literally it was the following Monday, my program was to start, and then the world changed, and we were all sent home with far too much free time on our hands and a very real feeling of being completely adrift, right? In March, 3 years ago, from when we're recording this. And as it was for many people, it was a time of great reflection. For me, it was a time of upheaval. I very quickly realized it for the opportunity that it represented to rethink everything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Everything, right? Mm-hmm. And I found solace in my front yard, where I ripped out a bunch of monoculture grass and started planting some food and spending time with my children, mm-hmm. and reflecting mm-hmm. on my career and what I wanted to do next and what there would be to do next, right? Mm-hmm. In that time of uncertainty. And then, you know, the months passed, and suddenly it was June of 2020, and George Floyd happened in front of us and impacted me emotionally. And as a week, the weeks followed, I realized I was having a secondary traumatic reaction. And that reaction was to the response, or really the lack of response, from the charitable sector, where I'd spent so much of my career, and, you know, believing that I was surrounded by people who believed in social justice and making things right, mm-hmm. you know, and that all of that bottled up stuff, I want to say rage, but, you know, in retrospect, I don't know if that's the right word to use, but all of that came bubbling out of me and onto a little Google Doc that I started, and I had absolutely, Kimberly, zero intention of showing it to anyone, because what came out of me, to my kind of surprise, was a really scathing review of the people in the nonprofit industry and the people on the program side, the people in the funding side, the entire industry. And as I wrote, I kept recalling all of these microaggressions and small attacks and sexual harassment and just everything. Mm-hmm. It all came pouring out. And it was the scariest thing I've ever written. And I immediately, you know, put it away and thought I'd never look at it again. As soon as I finished writing it, and just thought, oh, that was cathartic. That was a good feeling to just word vomit that out and close the notebook and walk away. But then I got an email in my inbox, and it was Voulet, with Nonprofit AF. And that email, you know, from line has always been ooh kind of response on a Monday morning, and really looking for a breath of fresh air. And what I found in there was the announcement of the launch of community-centric fundraise.
Okay. I wonder if you can, we're going to get into this, you know, fly in the milk and where that title came from. But I'm curious about, before we get into that, was there a particular moment? I mean, it sounds, the way you described that article, that it was a surprise that it came out and you didn't know that you were holding all of this trauma inside for 12 years.
Yes.
What was the moment like for you when you decided it was time to stop making people who look like me comfortable?
I think it was when I got that email. It inspired bravery in me. Because they asked for my story as I read that email. They asked for the stories of people who looked like me in this fundraising and nonprofit sector who had experiences to tell. Mm-hmm. And I immediately, impulsively thought, hey, I've got a story. I just wrote it down. Wonder if I sent it to them, if they'd want to publish it. Ha ha ha, he he he. I have nothing to lose anyway. I've been laid off, right? I thought, what the heck? And I literally just sent it to them and was like, you know, shot in the dark.
So thank you. You've written a piece that's quite powerful. And for listeners who will ultimately click through and watch your video and read your article, can you tell us a little bit about Fly in the Milk and what that metaphor means to you?
Oh, well, sure. And it's funny that, like, just culturally speaking, I'm surprised from my perspective that anyone wouldn't know what that phrase means. And what it means is the one Black person in a bunch of white people, mm-hmm. a fly in the milk, so to speak. And it's, you know, slightly derogative because, right, who would want a yucky, nasty fly in their lovely cup of unspoiled milk, right? But it's a phrase that's commonly known in my community, right? I went to a predominantly white college. Oh, you must have been a fly in the milk. Yep, sure was. Yeah.
That was your story. You were the fly in the milk at the charity that you loved for many, many years. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the realizations that you had after George Floyd?
Yeah, it was, I realized that I was holding my breath and waiting for a statement to come out from my former employer. And I suddenly realized how completely stupid I was to expect anything like that. And that's when the crack in the wall, the dam burst, really. Because I thought, you know, Marissa, seriously, why would they even consider this to be something that they would choose to respond to? You know, many nonprofits, charities, organizations, and I think, I don't know if it's as big a problem in Canada as it is in the US, but our legal structures make it such that nonprofits can be really reticent to engage in anything deemed political in nature.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. So there's always that. And also, yet, right, we all witnessed a murder in public view at the hands of, you know, the institution that people believe is here to protect and serve us. And a response was warranted, and there was none coming, and there would never be. And that realization just rocked me to my core and realized how many lies I had tricked myself into believing. Mm-hmm. Lies like, your coworkers care about you, right? Lies like, you know, oh, it's no big deal. The special privileges that the people in the VIP box get at the big event. And it's definitely not a big deal that, you know, Table 5 has a habit of groping their waitresses, right? And, you know, and the more I thought about all those little nasty lies I was complicit in, it sickened me and it made me angry with myself because I realized how much I had put up with and how much harm I had either borne or been complicit in causing by my silence.
Mm-hmm. And it's so subtle, right? These things are so subtle that people and organizations just, it's kind of habitual, this systemic racism that we've all been raised with. We don't even realize until we start to name it that it's harmful.
Right. You know, being in marketing especially, we're tasked with telling the stories of the organization. And in that, there is a great deal of power because it means we are the deciders of who is on the cover of that glossy publication that we're putting out to the public, right? And we are the ones that choose what they look like and which stories are amplified and all of that.
Mm-hmm. And yet, and this might be, again, really naive and ignorant question, but what is that line between sincerely amplifying diverse communities and being performative.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that. You were in an organization that was all white, and you said in your video that you were the one hiding behind the camera most of the time.
Absolutely.
So why were you more comfortable behind the camera?
Well, I wouldn't want to ruin the shot, right? I mean, if I look back at the few pictures they did manage to push me into, I do look like a fly in the milk. I do look out of place and slightly uncomfortable and sort of holding my breath in such a way as to not take up too much space or ever seem anything but, you know, super cheerful and bubbly. You know, raise your voice a couple of octaves when you answer the phone, and make sure that you use that absolutely perfect diction on the phone to make sure that nobody would think that, you know, I had it to where people were surprised when they would come into the office after talking with me on the phone, because I have developed, you know, masking techniques learned from being a Black person who went to private school and was on the honor roll and had to live in multiple different environments. My parents divorced when I was very young, and I learned how to be two different people, one at school and at mom's house, and another one at my dad's house on the weekend, where he had a different religion I had to fit into. There was a different dress code, different rules. So I've spent my life masking and fitting in to acclimate and succeed in whatever environment I'm in. And I think that's how I ended up at a position like that, how I put myself in a employment situation, which is a vulnerable situation, right? Where I was the only one there, and I knew the role I had to play and the, you know, appearance that went along with it. And I did it and tried my best to keep up the mask until the day came when I didn't need it anymore and felt like I didn't know the person under the mask anymore.
Yeah, that was leading me to my next curiosity. And that was, so when you take the mask off and you look in the mirror, what do you see?
And at that moment, I saw that I was failing myself, and worse, I was failing my son. So the piece, talks about my son who resembles and is near in age to one of the many Black male victims of police violence that happened here in Sacramento. And in it, in the essay, I talk a little bit about how, you know, I fear for my son's life every time he leaves the house as, bookish and anime loving and a little bit nerdy, right? Young adult who is just another Black kid in a hoodie from a glance, right? And I realized that by being complicit, by staying silent, by upholding all these structures of racism, I was failing the one person I wanted most to protect. And so I asked him after Community Centric Fundraising said, yes, Maris, we'd love to publish this piece. The first person I asked, of course, was him, because I mentioned him in the piece. And I asked his permission, and he gave it. And then I asked him to video me. And so he's my videographer. And I did a little video reading of the piece, and he's my videographer. And I tell you, that was the hardest thing I have ever videotaped in my life, looking right into his eyes as I did it. And I think we did it in like two takes, because that was as much as I could manage emotionally.
That must have been a really powerful moment stand in such vulnerable truth in front of your son. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Scariest and best thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
And I say it's the best thing because the way life turned out, here I am. It's, 3 years later now. I've created myself a little consultancy doing exactly what I love and being able to choose for whom I do it. And I choose my work environment and I choose my clients really, really carefully. And I have an equity and affinity based pay scale, to where I'm able to subsidize my work with, you know, Black and Indigenous and people of color, or people of the global majority is another way to say that, that I actually prefer. And prioritize my and subsidize my work with them and charge the, you know, large, well-funded, white-led organizations that I also work with at the top of my scale, transparently and openly. And I tell them that cheerfully, and they cheerfully pay me my top rate.
So, Marissa, what is it like now for you to be standing in your truth and operating from a position of power unapologetically?
It feels amazing. It's wonderful, and I'm grateful. It's challenging. I'm walking in spaces that I really didn't have the imagination to dream that I could be walking in, and I'm walking in them confidently, and that still feels new. But I have wonderful support around me, and it seems as though the braver and more honest that I am, the more success comes to me, and the more people resonate with me and come, you know, to me to work with or find solutions together. And so those neural pathways just keep getting reinforced. And I think I'm going to just keep doing that and keep walking in my truth, because, you know, the journey is not always easy, but that destination is brilliant.
End scene. Yes. Okay. That's where we're going to end. But I, as you were talking about how wonderful that is, I was thinking about, in addition to listening to you really intently, but I was also thinking about, as I listened to your video and I read your story, I was probably one of those people who had you behaving that way, who expected you to be more like me and less of yourself. And I thought of all of the people of color working in organizations that are primarily led by white people, and the overwhelming harm that we are causing because we're not having more conversations like this.
That's why it's important for people like you that have a microphone and an audience to amplify stories like this. So thank you for having me with you.
Well, that's not where I was headed, but I appreciate that. It's uncomfortable. This is not comfortable. Nobody wants to feel like they've caused harm, and yet most of us have in some way.
All of us have, right? Every day we walk around unintentionally causing harm to other things. Yeah. I mean, you know, if it's an ant on the sidewalk, right? Like it takes intention and mindfulness and practice to not go around randomly crashing into people, right? It takes hard work to remember that we never know what someone else is carrying, and that we should be kinder than we feel we need to be, right? That's hard work, and it's uncomfortable work. And it's especially uncomfortable for people who are carrying a lot of privilege, right? Mm-hmm. We exist in privilege, and it's never comfortable to really acknowledge how much privilege we have. Mm-hmm. And that's on many levels. I mean, just economic privilege, you know, having the privilege to travel, for example, and see how other people live and be more grateful for your conveniences and privileges and luxuries. Mm-hmm. Right. Like it's tough, and you have to make the choice to expose yourself to that. Right. It's much easier to just go to the Ritz 4-star hotel and live amongst other privileged and, you know, whatever folks. It's hard work to, you know, take a hard turn left and bypass the Ritz and go and stay with a host family and live as they live and live with them and learn from them right? That's a whole different travel experience if you had two to choose from. So it's.
And so when you take that intentionality and you apply it to organizations who truly want to know better and don't know how, I mean, this is your zone of genius, really, is to take this anti-racist lens and approach their fundraising activities through that lens.
Yeah.
So for folks who are listening to us right now, what might be some of the first questions they need to ask themselves or the first corners they might need to look in?
Yeah, it's a great question because that's really what everybody wants from me, right? As I go forth, you know, talking with people about improving these things, they want to know, what can I concretely do? What's a first step? And I always tell them that auditing what you already have and what you're already putting out is the first step. So like on the CCF website, there's a whole list of aligned actions, and you can go through it as a checklist and decide for yourself, are we perpetuating this particular harm? Are we, is there room for growth in this area of our messaging, for example? I worry a lot about things like poverty porn, like how are we describing the constituents that we're working with? How are we describing our community members who might be experiencing homelessness right now, right? How do we talk about people without othering them? How do we empower people without being savioristic, mm-hmm. right? So these are the hard questions you want to start asking. And my advice is always to try to find, if you can, because it's difficult. We're so wrapped up in our missions as nonprofit folks that all of our friends know all about our mission, right? It's hard to find an objective person. But if you can run things by someone who isn't in your organization, doesn't know or care about your mission, ideally somebody that is in your community, even one of your program members or constituents that you're serving, half the time they have no idea what you're communicating to your donors, right? They don't necessarily subscribe to your email like your email list like your donors do, right? Or they might be getting a different email. They might not realize that you're using language that they find harmful, mm-hmm. because they're not your target audience. Mm-hmm. And nobody said, hey, do you mind? We're writing this, and I just wanted to run it past you. You're a member of this community, and you work with us. You've been in our program, and you're having great progress, right? Blah, blah, blah. Relationship building, right? And I really value your opinion, right? And I'd love it if you wouldn't mind taking a quick look at this for me.
Such a simple thing to do.
So simple. You just include people and you ask people and you trust people and you be trustworthy.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy. They're easy principles to think of as an individual. The difficulty is in translating that to an organization, right? Making an organization intentional shift.
Yes.
It's a little tougher. It requires commitment from the top.
Yeah.
From the absolute top, or it's doomed, right? Like, if you don't have buy-in, there's just some diversity committee with no teeth, right? That just, you know, does nice little things that make everybody feel good and doesn't ask any hard questions or make any real change, you know, that little committee is really just perpetuating more harm, right? It's damaging your relationship with your community.
Yeah. Yes, we have a DEI committee, but we're doing absolutely nothing to combat racism in our organization.
Precisely. Or even just retain the few people of color we have working for us now.
Who are all on the DEI committee.
Well, of course, obviously.
Obviously.
Of course they are. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. If we were to end this conversation now, what's the thing that's left unsaid?
The thing that's left unsaid is where do we find the bravery as organizations? Because I think that is the most common thread running through the organizations that are actually making some change. It's the bravery to ask those hard questions, challenge the way that they've done things, question the way that they're treating their people. Mm-hmm. All of those things require institutional bravery. And, you know, it's easy for us on the front lines to say, hey, we're not doing this in the most optimal way, right? We know there are better ways to do this work. But until somebody can find the decision maker and give them a big shot of bravery in the arm, that change will never come. So I see my role as just going around and inspiring folks to find that shot. Mm-hmm. And deliver it. If it's your, you know, board of directors, if it's your executive director, whoever that is, needs to move past the risk averse, conflict averse, right? Controversy averse mindset that permeates the nonprofit sector, and just stand up and be brave and speak the truth. Mm-hmm.
Well, you certainly were very brave in shedding the persona of fundraising communications expert. And well, that's not right. That's not what you shed. What was it that you shed? How would you describe this emergence?
I think it's a transformation. You know, I don't know if I shed a chrysalis exactly. Or a shell or a mask. I love metaphors. I'll probably be sitting the rest of the afternoon. Well, no, it's this. But I shed the cloak that was keeping me from being my truest self.
I love the idea of a chrysalis. I love the idea of how much bigger you can become when you find your power and your truth, and how you're modeling that bravery and that vulnerability for others to follow. And that's the ripple. That's the ripple that you're contributing to with your openness and your work. So thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
Once again, thank you, Marissa, for your grace and for helping us all, including me, do better. You can find a link to Marissa's powerful essay, Fly in the Milk, in the show notes, or you can visit communitycentricfundraising.org and go to their blog. Thank you so much for making this conversation a priority in your day. We are so glad to have you as part of this community. Please be sure to join our emailing list at intersectionhub.ca to get new episodes sent directly to your inbox. And let's keep widening the circle and continuing these conversations by sharing this podcast. Thank you all for being part of this community. We are so glad you are here. See you next time.